Blog Talk Radio. Another edition of Let's Talk Footwork. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Thank you for joining us for what should be another great show. A reminder, we do not own the rights to the music you just heard. Also, please click tag and share. Tell someone Let's Talk Footwork is on the air. And tonight, we're trying to answer one question. Was there election fraud committed during the November 2022 election? Tonight, Kat Cano has agreed to come back and answer even more questions concerning the November 2022 election. In fact, the first hour, we will do a one-on-one interview. After that, she is willing to take questions in the second hour. There's an old saying that says, ask and you shall receive. Well, tonight we're asking, and hopefully we will get our answers. With that said, let's talk footwork. I see Kat is on the line. Good evening, Kat. How are you?
Hi. Can y'all hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Good evening. Great.
Thank you for coming. Thank you
for inviting me on the show to talk about things. A fair warning, I'm like a total nerd about elections, so I tend to talk about them kind of the way that like a Star Wars fan would just talk about Star Wars for hours. So if I start getting off topic or off a question, please feel free to interrupt me.
Okay, I'll do it. Listen, Kat, you know, a lot of people feel that you're pretty gutsy to be talking about what happened. So do you feel that, you know, that you're above what most people would consider a level of comfort to be talking about this, or are you totally at ease to be talking about what happened?
Well, there's a little bit of nervousness because I expected there to be an investigation, and I don't know anything about how law enforcement investigations are, and I wasn't mm-hmm. sure at first, should I just say nothing and wait for an official interview? Like, would this somehow affect an investigation? But, mm-hmm. And then also, like, I'm just a little nervous, like stage fright, as a lot of people right. are when they speak publicly. But other mm-hmm. than that, no, because I've always been really dedicated to voter education. I've always been very open about what happens on ballot board. I love telling people, like inviting them to come in and then walking them through processes. A lot of times during public testing or when we have poll watchers, I'll be the one like explaining, hey, here's what is happening. Here's what's going on. This is why we do this. This is, you know, a method we developed to fix a problem that we had before, and here's the history of it. So I actually really enjoy this stuff.
Okay.
So I guess people might think it's brave, but for me, it's just like, I like doing it. It's cool.
Well, great. Tell us how you got to be on the board. What type of experience did you have for you to be someone that they nominated to be on the board?
So I got involved with politics in 2018. Before that, I wasn't apolitical, but I really didn't do anything more than vote. In 2018, mm-hmm. Someone with the Beto campaign came and knocked on my door and asked me if I wanted to volunteer. And I was at that particular time, that was in the early fall of 2018, I had gotten, like we had just moved houses, myself and my mom. I was stable on medication for like the first time in several years. I was feeling really good. And I was just like, yes, this sounds awesome. After we lost that election, like the very next day, I went to the Democratic Party headquarters in Fort Worth and knocked on the door. And I was like, what can we do to make this not happen again? And so that's how I started volunteering with the Tarrant County Democratic Party. And then in 2019, I was deputy chair of the volunteer committee with another volunteer. And we spent a lot of time doing office work, volunteer for the county party. So we were in the office a lot. And that meant that I spent a lot of time with people in positions of authority in the party. In, I believe it was late spring. Yeah, because it was around the time Deborah Peoples was running for mayor. I started working on her campaign as like right after she announced as a volunteer. And then shortly after that, I became a precinct chair for the Democratic Party. And in fall of 2019, when we were looking for judicial candidates, I believe we had 10 of them in Tarrant. I was one of the main people responsible for organizing that petition drive and making sure that all the signatures that we got were valid signatures of people who are eligible to sign those petitions and making sure that we had enough to get our candidates on the ballot without having to pay a filing fee. Because for judicial candidates, I believe it's a $1,000 filing fee unless you have a certain number of signatures. I'm not sure about that number, but it's like a very high filing fee. That year, our previous ballot board judge resigned due to family issues. And when that happened, I was in the office and Deborah, you know, turned to me and she was like, I have a great job for you. You should be on the ballot board. At that time, mm-hmm. I didn't know what a ballot board was. I didn't know they existed and I didn't know what they did. But Deborah thought that I was very detail-oriented, very meticulous, a very hard worker, and that I would be a good person to put in position in that position because I would be someone who could, you know, really get into like the technicalities and really learn like what it's supposed to be doing and then stand up when I needed to do it. So that's
so Deborah Peoples is the one that nominated you to be on the ballot board.
Yes, she's the one who appointed me the first time. Yep.
Gotcha. So you work with the Democratic Party. Now, make this clear about why people keep calling you a libertarian if you're really a Democrat.
because on my Facebook profile, I put I'm a radical progressive socialist libertarian with the Democratic Party. And that's a very reductive sort of nebulous way of trying to explain that I have a lot of different varied beliefs. I have some conservative beliefs. I have some liberal beliefs. I have a lot of like radical progressive beliefs. I believe in socialist ideas like Medicare for all and, you know, eliminating student debt, making it possible for people to go to school without, you know, throwing their future funds away, things like that, like providing basic housing for people, things like that. But then I also think that there's like a limit to what the government can do. And I think that absolutely above everything else, the government needs to leave us alone and stay out of our business if we're not hurting anyone. So that would be the more libertarian side of my belief. And gosh, whoever made that video took that and just took it completely out of context.
Okay. So when you say they took it out of context, you're saying that the things they accused you of, you did not do.
Well, it depends on what it is. Because, like, for example, at the end of the video, they said I took a piece of paper out of the ballot boardroom. I absolutely did take a piece of paper out of the ballot boardroom, but it's not what they're implying it is. When I say they took it out of context, I mean they took the, like, the little, you know how small those Facebook descriptions are where you're supposed to write, like, a whole biography about yourself?
Right.
I think basically something that was, like, sort of all over the place, and they took that and interpreted it to mean I'm a libertarian, I'm a secret libertarian who's working for the Democratic Party as though I'm not a Democratic voter or Democratic activist. So that's what's out of context.
Okay. So when they talk about the document that you and Jocelyn Pankey both appeared to take, you know, each of you had a document. Do you still have a copy mm-hmm. of that document?
I don't know if I have the copy of the one from October because there were two of them. There was one for one day and one from the other. And right. I'm not very organized, so I don't know what I did with it after I used it because it's only useful for one day. It's only useful mm-hmm. at the end of the day because, and I explained this last week to listeners, but it's basically just a list of how many ballots are in what status at the end of the day. And, of course, that changes the next day as soon as you start doing any work with ballots, those numbers change.
Okay.
So I may have put it in a box. I may have disposed of it, like torn it up or shredded it or something. I don't remember.
Okay.
But I didn't tell you I definitely didn't, in case I do, because that would be a lie.
You said what?
I don't want to tell you that I definitely don't have it and then, like, you know, tomorrow find it, because I don't, you know, that would be a lie. I don't know if I have it or not.
Gotcha. You know, you talk, I kind of looked at your Facebook page, and you talk mm-hmm. a lot about ADHD, and you talk a lot about bipolarism. That thing mm-hmm. is... Now let's start with one first. Let's talk about ADHD. I have a relative that's ADHD, and mm-hmm. it's absolutely impossible to get them to do anything that's repetitious. They can start a task, but typically after a short period of time, they're either bored or something that will trigger them mm-hmm. not to be able to stay on task. So when you say you're ADHD, isn't that something that you grow out of, the hyper part of it? So are you more ADD or are you ADHD?
Well, there's a little bit of conflict in the literature. So when I started college, I was a psych major. Well, I wasn't when I started, but I started studying psychology in college, and that was the thing. I started taking graduate classes in it. So when I say things like literature and stuff, it's just because I'm a nerd and I read a lot. Mm-hmm. But, like, if you talk to professionals about this, ADD and ADHD may not be different things. Other people argue mm-hmm. that they are. Some people say mm-hmm. you grow out of the hyperactivity, and that there's a difference between childhood ADHD and adult ADHD. And mm-hmm. But it also manifests in different ways. So generally mm-hmm. people with ADHD, in order to get them engaged in an activity, there's a mnemonic device for it, and I can't remember what it is, but essentially mm-hmm. it has to be either new, like novel, something they haven't done before. It has to be mm-hmm. interesting, like something that mm-hmm. that they, whatever their brain chemistry is, they particularly latch onto it. challenging. So if it's easy to do, it's really boring, we don't like doing it. Or something else, and I don't remember what the other things are. But yes, I am the kind of person who like starts like a million projects and never finishes them. I have a very difficult time remembering like calendar dates and times. Like I'm perpetually confused about whether or not it's Tuesday or Wednesday. I have a really hard time being on time anywhere. Even if I leave like an hour early, I will still find some bizarre way to be 15 minutes late, and things like that. So yes, I do get bored easily, but there's also something in ADHD called hyperfocus, which is like you can sit and do something for hours and ignore everything else and just sort of get lost in it. And I do that as well.
Because I would think, you know, judging from the relative that I know that has the ADHD, I would think that a controlled environment that is as guarded as that, you know, environment is with all the cameras and you know, having to stay on task all day to complete, you know, this and this, you know, just 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I would think that would be hard for someone that struggles with ADHD.
It's actually not, because of the thing I said about it has to be interesting. Like, this is really interesting work. It's something I personally am very passionate about. I love the idea that I can help voters exercise their fundamental right to franchise. And also, it is very varied work. Like, there are periods where we're like, oh, we're going to do signature verification for the whole week. But there's a lot of different parts, like tasks, individual tasks that you can do, where it sort of is, it's not monotonous. It's not like sitting in an office doing spreadsheets all day, right? And it's also not something that I do constantly for work, so that makes it novel every time we do it. We only work about, I want to say it's about 4 weeks in election. So we start 3 weeks before election day and then a week after. So it's a very short period, and it's only a couple of times a year. So it never really has time to become, you know, the boring day job. So I have not found that to be a problem.
Okay. Well, then let's talk about the bipolarism, because I've looked at some of your posts on Facebook, and you mentioned the bipolarism and some of the effects of it. I would think that bipolarism definitely would affect your ability to stay on task and do that. How are you able to be so high functioning at that job and then struggle with the bipolarism?
I'd say most of the time I'm on medication, like very good medication. The problems that I've been having recently about bipolar that I've been posting about, most of them happened years ago. Like I've been posting some about my history of like one time when I was bipolar, I did this or I did that. Those were things that I did when I was like a teenager or a young adult when I was not on medication. I've been stable on medication since 2018, and I've only gone off of it twice. Once I went off of it, I don't actually remember why I went off of it, but it was during a spring, like a winter period, so there were no elections. And then in summer of 2020, I changed medications. So there was a period of adjustment with that, but it was, again, it was between elections. And then this last time when I went off of it, in October, I started having kidney stones, October last year. And I have had kidney stones in the past, but they normally go away after a couple of days. And this time they didn't. And they ended up lasting about 6 weeks. So I stopped taking all of my medication. That was a deliberate, intentional choice in consultation with my doctor, because I didn't know what was going on with my kidneys. And one of the medications I was taking can be very harsh on the liver. So I was absent for a lot of the October-November election last year. And then I didn't get back on when I started getting medication again this spring, I had had a liver test, like a blood test done to test liver function, and it was not normal. So I had to change medication. So this spring I've been adjusting to a new medication regimen. And several weeks ago, right after the May election started, I actually had a manic episode, which I hadn't had in several years. And I ended up being out for about 2 weeks while I was recovering from that.
What is a manic episode?
So a manic episode, it's part of bipolar disorder. So the reason it's called bipolar is because you have swings between manic episodes and depressive episodes. And the type I have is bipolar type 1, which means I have full-blown manic episodes. So I'm just going to tell you what I did that day, and so hopefully you'll understand it. I started out, I was at ballot board. We were working normally. I was functioning well. We got off around noon, I think, because it was a short day. And I decided to call my mom and ask her if I could buy like a mouse for my laptop, because the touchpad is, you know, a little tricky to use. And I had another job coming up where I would be doing a lot of like clicking and switching between screens and stuff. And I thought I needed a mouse. And then, so I went to Best Buy and I was looking at mice, and then I was like, oh, I need a keyboard. So I started looking at keyboards, and then I was like, oh, you know what? I need a webcam. So I started looking at webcams, and then I was like, if I'm going to get a webcam, I really need a light for a webcam. So I had to get one of those. And then I started, you know, looking around, and I was like, oh, that's a nice monitor. I want that monitor. I should get that monitor. And so I ended up buying all these things that I didn't need. And I didn't realize until I was like leaving the store with all this stuff that that is a weird behavior for me. I normally don't do things like that. And so I called my mom. Well, I didn't call her. No, I was thinking about it on the way home. And then when I got home, I told my mom, I've done something bad. We need to go back and return all of this because I spent way too much money on all of this stuff. And it was like all my money. I spent all my money on things I didn't need. And I didn't even notice that anything was weird until after I had done it. And when we went back to the store to return it, I started freaking out. Like, I was having a little panic attack because I knew that I was having manic feelings. The way my mom described it, I was talking too loud and too fast about private business in the store, which I normally don't do. Normally, I'm the one who tells her, hey, can you keep it down? We don't need to air our business to everyone. But I was having a panic attack. I was talking about, you know, I think I'm having a manic episode, and what if my doctor doesn't believe me, and what am I going to do, and this is going to ruin the future, and everything like that, like out loud in the return line. And then it got worse as the day went on. So when we got home, it was actually when I was leaving the store, I sent a text message to my doctor saying, I think I'm having a manic episode and a panic attack. Can we schedule a session? So he asked me to describe what was happening, and I did. And while I was manic, like when you're manic, you don't have a lot of self-regulation. Like for me, things that I'm thinking, they just come out. Like I don't have a filter. So I started typing like everything that I was thinking, and I wasn't paying attention to like how I was typing or how words were spelled. It was just like this flow of words and ideas that were coming from my head. It was basically incoherent garbage. And I couldn't stop. And then like halfway through the end, like I ended up bursting into tears of like hysterical laughter. It was hysterical laughter, and then it was actual sobbing, like really deep, horrible sobbing, because I was sad all of a sudden. That's how a manic episode goes for me. It's really like you literally, if you saw me, you would think I was crazy.
So has either your bipolarism disorder or the ADHD affected your ability to do your job in any way in the ballot courtroom at any time?
Other than occasionally being like this, you know, this last election, I was out because I was recovering from that. So other than that and the fact that I'm basically chronically late because I can't keep track of time, I don't think so. And I think if it had, David or someone else would have said something to me, and no one has ever mentioned my behavior to me, and it would be really obvious if I were, you know, suffering from something like that during work.
Gotcha. Do you believe that either your bipolar disorder or the ADHD may have altered your decision making and caused you to maybe make a bad choice that you ordinarily would not have made as a ballot board member?
No.
All right, just trying to get some clarity about
it's a reasonable question, and if I were a different kind of person, I might say yes, but I don't think it has. When I'm not having a manic episode, I'm a very thoughtful person, but also the whole point of ballot board is that, like, we make decisions as a group. Like, the judge is the ultimate arbiter of what we do, but if we need to do something, we discuss it. So there's a lot of monitoring and, like, group decision-making. We don't just do things impulsively. We have procedures, and the way that we've worked out procedures is we've learned through experience what works and what doesn't. And if we think that something isn't working, then we have a discussion about it and say, what could we do differently?
I back to me looking at your Facebook page. I saw some of your posts where you described the bipolar episodes, and I think I was disturbed by the one where you described the diva cup. And to be honest with you, I didn't even know what that was. Though somebody had described me what that was. That was exactly weird. But anyway, so in that post, I would think, and maybe there's a difference in our age, I'm sure it is, but I would think that was not a wise post to make, especially under the circumstances of everything that's going on. Did you ever question that post and whether or not it made, like, was it a good decision to make to post that? Or did you never think about that? Never? Okay.
It's not like I didn't think about it and I did it impulsively. I thought about it while I was writing it and I made the decision to post it, but I don't second guess that decision. I'm not sure if that one was public or friends only. I guess it was public, but I don't, I'm not embarrassed by things like that. it has a hashtag on it that says TMI. That's sort of just the way I am. I'm very open about, you know, medical things. I don't find them embarrassing. I don't think we should try and hide them. I know that may make some people uncomfortable, but it's my Facebook page, and if you don't like it, then you don't have to read it.
And this is very true. I would be nosy. But to put it in context, everybody's like, what are they talking about? I'm just going to paraphrase. Or maybe you want to tell them what the post was, so maybe you know you wrote it. You could tell them so that they understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, so... Last weekend, let me see. I've posted several things since then, so I just want to get the date wrong.
Something like the disinformation.
It was 2 days ago. Okay, so I was, I was stressed out from the fallout of this whole thing, and last weekend my period started, and it has been, I'm going through perimenopause. So lately my period's been really, you know, quiet and not a big deal, just bleed a little and then ignore it. But when I was younger, I had really erratic, very heavy periods. And so I've been having one of those. And so I use a diva cup, which is a kind of menstrual cup. So I don't use tampons or pads. It's reusable. But it fills up, and every once in a while, you have to empty it. And most of the time, they say it can last 8 to 12 hours. And for me, it's much shorter than that. So it's been very disruptive to my life. And then, like, it literally, like, I mean, ladies, y'all understand this. Sometimes you have an accident, and there's blood on something. For me, it's like a lot of blood right now. And it's very upsetting and frustrating. And it was a lot to deal with all of this stress as well. So I posted that on my Facebook page because I think it's actually healthy for society to be able to talk about what happens with women's bodies. Most of my friends are women, and I think it's actively harmful to us to, like, pretend that nothing bad ever happens or to, like, not share that information. I didn't know even what perimenopause was until I heard a radio show about it, and I was like, I'm having that because no one ever talked to me about it. So that's why I post things like that, is to just, you know, help destigmatize it, you know?
Right.
That's just the reason I post things.
I think the part that, and trust me, I'm quirky myself in many ways, but it was a line between, you know, I think it was a fine line rather between quirky and like it was a part about the murder scene kind of threw me a little bit. And so I just you know, I'm wondering, because see, a lot of people are posting on social media, oh, she's trying to play crazy. So if anything ever, you know, happens, she can say she's crazy. And so they were saying that some of the posts that have been, you know, you've been posting on social media lately are trying to draw the narrative that if anything happens, okay, I was crazy. So that's what I was asking the previous question, you know, did any of this, you know, with ADHD and the bipolarism possibly affecting decision making? And so,
no, that's just who I am. That's how I've always been. And if I actually needed to play crazy, all I would do is, you know, tell them to publish my mental health history. I have a long history. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when I was 14. And I was in and out of doctors since then. I was with MHMR for several years. I've been with my current doctor for, I think, 3 years. Okay. There's a long history of my mental illness documented, mm-hmm. but I mm-hmm. wouldn't do that because I'm not like crazy. I'm not like schizophrenic or anything like that where I have some sort of dissociation from reality.
Okay.
I don't see myself using that defense. I'm just a very open person, and my friends get that, and people who don't like it are not my friends, and that's fine with me.
And you know what? I noticed that you have, like, a real large friend base. There seems to be a lot of people, you know, judging from the comments, and I'm going to stop snooping, I promise I am, but it's just a investigative finger in me. But it seems like you have a lot of people who care about you. And love you and wish the best for you, which I'm sure that's something that you need right through here.
Yeah, it has been very comforting. I'm not actually a very social person. I'm an introvert. It's very difficult for me to make friends. And I didn't really have friends until I started working in the Democratic Party and getting to know people. And everyone has been, well, everyone that I know, I have Republican friends and I have Libertarian friends, and they've all been supportive. A lot of them were like, don't let it get to you. Don't resign. Just, you know, you haven't done anything wrong. Just stick with it. And that was very, I mean, it made me feel so loved. I've appreciated it so much. And it has been like absolutely critical, not just to go through this, you know, these accusations and to be able to cope with that. But in general, mm-hmm. as someone with mental illness who struggles a lot with depression, especially, if I'm ever feeling down, I just, you know, I say it. And then I have everyone being like, you know what, you can get through this. We love you. You're amazing. And that sort of support, that is so critical for people to be able to cope with mental illness, like having that support mm-hmm. network. And mm-hmm. I really wish more people had strong groups like that to support them.
I agree. Listen, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Kat Tano. She's the Democratic ballot board member that was recently featured on a YouTube video from Progressives for Liberty, who have accused Kat of election fraud in some type of way. And Kat is tonight coming back for a second interview in which she is telling her side of the story. So in the second hour, Kat has agreed to take questions. But right now, we're just trying to better understand the things that we saw in the video so that it makes sense for everyone. That said, Kat, we talked in the pre-interview this morning about the fact that members of the ballot board room are allowed to bring in phones, purses, backpacks, and even lunch boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you confirm that that's true?
Yeah, that is true. If you've seen the video, you'll notice that you know, people are getting their jackets and their purses and stuff from the lockers that we have in the room. Mm-hmm. We have always, since I've been allowed to work there, and presumably before, because no one said this was new, everyone has always brought their personal effects into the ballot board room. We didn't always have lockers, actually. when I first started, we didn't have anywhere to put anything. We just sort of stuck them under the table where we were working or in a chair or something. So the lockers are relatively new, and we actually asked for them because we were sick of tripping over each other's stuff. But in hindsight, and it's so easy to see things in hindsight, isn't it? I can see where some people would a problem to have, you know, bags and stuff in a room where you have sensitive materials, especially because there are some materials that we do take out of the room, and because there are some materials that we are allowed to take out of the room. And if I put something in my purse, you don't know if it's an election record or just like a piece of paper where someone gave me their email address, like a ballot board member gave me their contact information or something. You don't know. So I can see that that is problematic. And what I will recommend to the people who are staying on, to our presiding judge and to election staff, is that we set up somewhere outside the room where, that we can use for locker space. Now, as to eating food and stuff in there, that's always been something we've done. On election night, especially because we work long hours, we do eat dinner, and we tend to eat snacks and stuff in the room. So the only thing that has ever been posted in that room since I've been there is a sign on the wall that says no open cups. Like all cups must have sealable lids. And I think that's a great rule because we have sometimes knocked over like tea or coffee on piles of papers, and it's not good. I mean, but there's never in my experience been any sort of restriction on like being allowed to eat or like have a break time in that room. And I don't know why. Like I wasn't there for I don't know who decided that was a good policy. I don't know if it's ever been mentioned that, hey, that's a bad policy. I don't know anything about it. It's just how things have always been since I've been there. There is a break room outside the room, but it's very small. There's not really enough room for all of us to sit in it at one time. There's a couple of picnic tables outside, but we don't use them like when it's raining. And there's very limited space outside the room where we could sit to eat in a large group. So the reason I think that we do it is mostly just convenience.
Okay. So how many people are in the ballot board at one time? Is there a specific number of people that work on these elections?
There is not. It depends entirely on how much work is to be done and how little time. So there, in 2020, we had upwards of, I want to say 40 to 60 people working on ballot board at any given time because of the work we had to do in the 2020 election. We just needed that many people, and we were working very long hours. On a small election like a municipal, normally you'd have anywhere between 6 and 12, depending on how much work you have to do. The presiding judge is the one who decides how many people need to work and how long. And that's a determination that we make based on experience. And also we do sometimes time, like how long it takes to do specific activities, so that we know, like, if two people are doing this task for X amount of time, they will be able to work on X amount of ballots. And then we can use that to estimate how many people it's going to take to get through a certain amount of work. So it's all decided as we go, though. Like, if we bring in 12 people on a Monday, we may only need, like, 4 people or 6 people on a Tuesday. Because if we finish everything really fast, then you don't really need that many people to keep up with whatever comes in later.
How many cameras are in those rooms?
There are so it's two rooms. There's a large room with the computers and the mail sorter, and then there's a smaller room, which is not, like, a room. It's a closet, basically. And so there's 6 in total. There's, in the large room, there's one, and it's not quite a square, so it's not quite all 4 corners, but it is essentially, the corner by the door, the corner opposite that, the corner diagonal to that, and then the corner opposite in the other direction, which is above mm-hmm. where the scanning station is. So there's four in there. Two of them are live streams, the ones that are diagonal to each other, the door and the one that's diagonal to it. The other two are not, but they are, you know, they've been there since I came on, I think they've been there the whole time I've been working there. And those have been used before to check on certain things that happened in the ballot boardroom. Like one time we opened a machine and the seal fell, the internal seal that seals the drives inside of it fell out mm-hmm. of the machine. And normally the ballot board is the one who who cuts the seals, takes the seal number, cuts the seals, and then opens the internal thing and extracts the memory drive from it. So we don't like it when those seals are broken. But when we opened the box, the seal fell out, and Tarrant County Elections actually went and retrieved the video to show that that is actually what happened. So there's four in that room, and then in the closet, there's at least one camera that has always been there as well. And there is also a live stream feed from that internal closet. I don't know, because I didn't bother looking, whether that is a separate camera from the one that has already been there. So there may be five, there may be six. But there's definitely at least one camera in that room, and there's definitely a live stream from that room.
So how many angles, how many cameras do we see in that YouTube video?
There are two. I don't think there's a view inside the closet. And I want to mm-hmm. also mention the live stream that's from inside the closet, as far as I know, was not there at all last year. It was added this year. So in the October video, there are two angles. There's one by the door. That's the one you're going to see at the end of the video when Jocelyn and I are printing things. That camera is like right over the door. That's the only door into that room. Then in a couple of places in the video, I think when Jocelyn and I are talking to David about like next to the mail cart, that view is the camera that's opposite from the door. So there's two mm-hmm. views in there.
So can you tell us specifically what tasks are performed in the ballot board room? So specifically, what are you all doing when you're in there? Can you give us a rundown of what the job descriptions are that you all are doing?
I can, and I'll try to keep it short because it's actually a lot of things. So in the ballot board room specifically, we do two primary things. One is we do signature verification, and that is done by signature verification committee. And so that's the first week of the election, and then it continues on all the way through the election because we accept overseas mail from military voters, overseas mail. That's mm-hmm. able to be delivered up to, don't quote me on this, I want to say it's 4 days after the election, but I'm so bad with these numbers. So if something comes in up to 4 days after election day and it is eligible to be counted because it's an overseas mail ballot, then we can accept it and we'll have to do signature verification on that. And signature verification mm-hmm. is the part where we actually examine the application for the ballot and the signature on that, and we compare it against the signature that's on the ballot. And then we also verify that the ID numbers are the ones that belong to that voter. So that's, you know, that's a big chunk of what we do. And then the actual ballot board, which is legally separate from the signature verification committee, but in mm-hmm. practice involves the same people just because staffing is a problem. The ballot board is the one that actually we transfer. It's not like a formal transfer. There's no official chain of custody form for it, as long as I know, but we have invented our own chain of custody document. So the mm-hmm. signature verification committee, after it approves a ballot, they transfer those ballots, ballot board, and the ballot board is the one that's responsible for opening them and examining the ballot and ensuring that the ballot gets counted. And as part of that, one of the things that we also do is we have to make sure that any ballots that cannot be scanned on our system are duplicated in a manner that can be scanned in our system. And that's actually covered by the election code. There's a specific provision in it that says that we are, because we use electronic counting, we are allowed to duplicate a ballot for the purposes of electronic counting. And that is one of the things that we do with the e-ballot because it cannot be recognized.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. You said opening them. You mean opening what?
I mean opening the ballot envelope. So the signature verification committee is not supposed to open envelopes. We're not supposed to open the ballot envelope. The only exception that we make for that is if there is a notice of statement of residence on the envelope where someone is required to submit a statement of residence with their ballot in order for it to be counted. It's, I think they may have changed the color. It used to be yellow. I'm not sure if it's still yellow, but it's like a little miniature voter registration form. If you get one, you have to return it, and the envelope is marked so that we know that it has a statement of residence. And the status it has in our system also indicates that it has to have a statement of residence. So the signature verification committee send the external carrier envelope to look for a statement of residence. And if they can't find it, they are not supposed to open the security envelope where the ballot is. If that happens, we put that on, we're supposed to, I don't know if everyone always does it because it can be easy to forget, but we're supposed to send the ballot to question status and put it in the ballot board. The only thing that's a little bit problematic with that is that with ballot carrying, if you don't include a statement of residence, you are allowed to be notified and fix that problem. So what we do now is sometimes if we can't find a statement of residence, we will feel the envelope because you can actually tell if it's thicker than it needs to be, and you can kind of feel if there's another piece of paper in there. And then we will open the security envelope and check inside. We won't take the ballot out, but we'll just see if we see inside the statement of residence. And then if we don't, we can notify the voter that they don't have one and they need to cure their ballot. But generally, the signature verification committee does not open envelopes at all. That is the only exception to that rule.
So you all open the envelopes, not the signature committee.
Right. So the ballot board is allowed to start opening envelopes 2 weeks before the election. And in the election code, it actually says like a certain amount of days, but in practice, it's 2 weeks before the election or election day. And then the ballot board is the one that opens the envelopes, and then we take the security envelopes out and we separate those two envelopes so that no one can tie a specific ballot back to a specific voter. And then after we've taken the security envelopes out, we open those, and then we take the ballot out. And then there's some checking of stuff, like making sure we have, the right number of ballots and counting them and stuff. But we examine all the ballots. We make sure that there's no damage on them, that they're marked correctly. And by correctly, I mean that the boxes are filled in all the way with like a dark pen. Anything that's not filled in correctly, if people put like check marks or X's or they circle their choices instead, it's called an irregularly marked ballot. And depending on how it's marked, we actually have a different method of processing it so that it can be counted correctly. But if assuming everything's marked correctly, it just goes in a pile and it we wait to count it, and it goes in a scanner after it's ready to be counted. So that's basically what we do. There's a lot of little nuances in there, but that's what we do. Signature verification committee does the verification. Ballot board does the opening and the counting. And then another thing that we do that if you ever go back and watch the videos, you might see after early voting, and this is a big important part of our job. After early voting, the machines, like the scanners that are at early voting locations, they are brought back sealed to us. And we are responsible for processing those results. I don't know how they did it in the May election because I wasn't there for it. I think I was there for the November election. I want to say I was. We did it in Central Counting Station, which is in a different part of the building, but it also has a live camera feed. The sealed boxes are placed like out on a table, and we have documentation for each box saying what the serial numbers of all the seals are. And we have usually three members of the ballot board, a Libertarian, a Democrat, and a Republican working. And oftentimes if it's like David will send me and like one of the Republicans and one of the Libertarians over there. Mm-hmm. Because as the alternate judge, I have, you know, he'll be like, okay, you're the alternate judge. You go over there and you handle that. Mm-hmm. So I believe that's what we did in October, although I won't swear to it without going back and watching the video. And basically what we do is like we record all of that stuff. We open up the boxes. We take the little tiny seal out of the inside. We record that. All of that stuff is saved. Like we save the seals in a bag. And then we extract the memory drive that has all the recorded votes on it, and we watch it be uploaded into the counting computer so that we can verify that those results came out of the machine, directly out of the machine, and went directly into the computer.
Gotcha. Do you feel that the position as a ballot board member at any time was too stressful for you to handle, considering the ADHD and the bipolar disorder?
Oh, absolutely not. I love it. Okay. It's exactly the sort of thing that, like, piques my interest. So I'm always, like, really excited to get back into ballot board and start working. It's, in my opinion, probably the best job I've ever had. Like, mm-hmm. I used to study Alzheimer's disease when I was in college. Like, that's an actual mm-hmm. thing I did. You know, I ran experiments on mice. We did histology, like examining their samples of their brains and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. we did some work at, it's called a synchrotron. It's like a big particle accelerator that we would travel to in Long Island. So, like, I did interesting things in college, and that's not even half as interesting as ballot board work, to tell you the truth. So I've never okay. found this job to be stressful. I think it's amazing.
So when, you know, people talk about election fraud, you know, if there is any errors, would you say it is due to the machine possibly making an error, or would it be human error?
I say if there are any errors, you know what, I can't like ultimately, this is like a philosophical question. You can't say, you can't prove a negative. I can't mm-hmm. say that there's no such thing as a machine error, but what we do is we try everything that we can to make sure that the machines are accurate. That's, mm-hmm. we do that through a process called public testing. It's a logic mm-hmm. and accuracy test. And before each election, all the machines that are going to be used in the election are tested with sample ballots that we know, like we have a control sample, and then mm-hmm. all of those are put through the machines to make sure that they can reproduce the ballot accurately and that that ballot can be counted accurately. And since I started doing this in 2020, I have never seen a machine error. I have seen errors in public testing that are the result of, you know, a technician duplicating the wrong ballot or forgetting to check the box or checking the box for the wrong candidate. I've seen all sorts of things like that, but I have never seen a machine counting error. Every error that we find during public testing has to be documented, which means we have to sit down and figure out what happened and write a note about it that is included with, you know, the documentation for the public test, and explain what mm-hmm. exactly happened. And I have never found anything that we couldn't explain. I have never found anything that had anything to do with the machine. The only machine errors that I have ever seen are like physical errors where like the battery failed or, you know, one of the plugs stopped working. So that machine gets returned to the manufacturer for service and we test another machine and replace that, like change out the machines, right? So those are the mm-hmm. only kind of machine problems I've ever seen. We do that for the ballot board scanner as well. That's part of the public test. And then we have seen like errors in like our numbers. Like this last election, in fact, we had a really interesting error because the number of ballots, and this might sound weird to y'all. I promise y'all it's not. We wrote an affidavit about it, but it's a little bit complicated. If it sounds weird, feel free to circle back and like send me an email or something and I can – oh, actually, it's on my Facebook. It's a public post on my Facebook. I wrote a whole long post about it. Basically, in ballot board, we had like 2,478 votes or something like that. That's not the number, but it was something like that. And then when we went over and we took it to central counting, we were one off. Like, it showed that we had one more ballot than Central Counting said we had. And it took us a couple of hours, I think, to figure out what had gone wrong. And basically, this is a known problem that HART, the person who manufactures our software, knows about. And what happened was North Richland Hills had four-page paper ballots for the mail-in ballots this time. So page 1, 2, 3, and 4, which is 8 sheets, because both all four pages are double-sided. And when they had been scanning those ballots, and I wasn't there for the scanning process, they had a lot of paper jams. And when you have paper jams with the multi-page ballots, you have to be really careful. And also when you're preparing them to be scanned, you have to be really careful to keep all four or all of the multi-page ballots together. So if you have one ballot that's four pages, all of those ballots have to be together. All of those pages have to be together. And when they had paper jams, they had ended up splitting a stack of multi-page ballots into two stacks. And page 1 got in one stack, and page 2, 3, and – no, I'm sorry, it's backwards. Page 1, 2, and 3 got in one stack, and page 4 went into another stack. So when we do a scan of ballots, it's called a batch. And there's two things we refer to as batch. But so we call it a scan batch. So the scan batches do not talk to each other. So it saw scan batch A that had pages 1, 2, and 3 in it, and it saw scan batch B that had page 4 in it. And because they don't talk to each other, even though the serial numbers on those ballot pages were the same, the system, when it started counting it on our end, saw two different ballots. But when we took it over to Central Counting, Central Counting doesn't care about the batches. It only cares about the serial numbers. So Central Counting saw all four of those pages as the same serial number and recognized it as the same ballot. So Central Counting number was actually correct. It's just that because of the way that they were scanned on our end, it looked like we had one more ballot than we did. And we were able to document that to prove it. We actually opened up the sealed box of ballots and put them all out on the table and went back and looked through the scanning logs to find where that page had gone. And it turned out that that's exactly what HART says will happen if you do that to batches. We know that that can happen. And in the past, when we've had multi-page ballots, we've been very deliberate about scanning them in their own separate batches and making sure that all of the pages are together sequentially so that that doesn't happen. And there's actually a really easy way to prevent this from happening in the future by unchecking a box that says accept incomplete ballots. The downside to that is that if someone only mails you one page of a multi-page ballot, like they only mail you page 1 because they didn't want to vote on any of the propositions, then you have to remake that ballot in a way that the scanner can count it. So it introduces a different kind of complexity.
Gotcha.
So there's
Let me switch gears just a little.
That's an error I've ever seen.
Okay. Have you ever witnessed either Haida Garcia or anyone on the ballot board doing anything out of the ordinary that would alter the results of the election?
No.
Okay.
Just asking.
For inquiry minds want to know. That's a fair question.
But my answer is no, and that is what I will testify on a court of law if necessary.
Okay, gotcha. Has anyone in either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party offered you money to alter the results of the election?
No. And, I mean, this doesn't mean anything if you don't believe my story anyway, but if they did, I would report them for trying to bribe an election official because that's not cool.
Okay. Have you ever removed ballots from the ballot boardroom?
The answer to this is yes, and I'm going to explain why, so bear with me, because in certain cases we are legally obliged to do it. So one of the things that we do is we process provisional ballots. Provisional ballots, if you've never had to vote one, it's like when you go to a polling place and you're not on the poll book, you are allowed to vote a provisional ballot. That ballot gets returned to the elections office, and the voter registrar actually examines that voter registration and makes sure that that person is eligible to vote and then makes a recommendation to the ballot board as to whether or not we should accept and count that ballot. Those ballots are delivered to the ballot board. We examine the information that's provided to us about the voter registration. The voter registrar provides us that information, and then we decide whether or not we're going to accept or reject. So ultimately, it's the ballot board that makes the determination as to whether or not a provisional vote gets counted. Some of y'all may be familiar with the Crystal Mason case, where Crystal Mason voted a provisional ballot and was not eligible to do so. And the thing that really annoys me about that case is that her ballot was never counted because the voter registrar did not recommend that it should be approved for counting, and the ballot board did not count it. That ballot was rejected. So she showed up and did what hundreds of thousands of people in Texas do every year, vote a provisional ballot, even though she wasn't eligible to do so. And she was targeted out. She was specifically targeted to make a point about election fraud. And so that's what the ballot board does. We actually check and see if those ballots are eligible. And if they are eligible, we count them. And if they're not, we don't count them. I keep wanting to say last week because I have no sense of time, but it was actually on election day. We had some early voting provisional ballots that had been rejected, and we don't retain those ballots. Those ballots have to go to the voters registrar's office so that they can be scanned into the system. A provisional ballot record becomes part of the voter record. So like if you ever go and vote a provisional ballot, there'll be a scan of that provisional envelope that's attached to your voter file as part of your voter history. So David told me to take a box of rejected provisional ballots back to the voter registrar's office. And so I did. Mm-hmm. He didn't tell anyone to go with me. He was just like, here, take these back. And I went and took them back. So I'm actually on camera leaving the room with a box of ballots and then coming back with nothing. And if you don't understand the reason for it, like that looks really sketchy, right? It looks suspicious. But if you know what's going on, it's actually just a normal part of our job.
What day did that? Was that every day or was that a specific day?
No, that was actually election day, this last May 6th.
Whoa,
but we do have to do that for every election because for every election, we have provisional ballots to process, and the ones that we don't approve to be counted, they have to be returned to the voter registrar's office for processing. We're not responsible for them. Also, the envelopes from the provisional ballots that we accept, we take the ballots, we store the ballots, those are our ballots, but the envelopes go back to the voter registrar's office. So there might be at any point during an election, like after early voting is over or after election day, where someone leaves the ballot board room with what looks like a stack of ballots, but it's actually just empty envelopes. So, you know, that can happen. There's also the case of sometimes if we get a ballot that's not checked in, and I think I told you about this during our pre-interview, but it's a little bit complicated. I don't want to get too much into the weeds of it, but sometimes we'll, because we put our ballots through a mail scan or mail sorter that scans the image of the ballot, and sometimes two envelopes can get stuck together in there. And so that means that we may get a batch of ballots where we have a ballot that is not in the system because it got stuck or someone dropped a pile of ballots and they got mixed together or something like that. And so that ballot is not checked in. We do not legally have custody of that ballot. Legally, the elections office still has custody of that ballot. So we have to take that ballot out of the room and transfer it to the elections office, like give it back to them because it's not our ballot. We legally can't do anything with that ballot except give it back to the people who are supposed to have custody of it. So there are times when people will walk out of the ballot board room with a ballot in hand and come back with nothing because we had to give it back to someone else. And we try to remember to do that in pairs, but because it's just we see it as just a normal part of our job, we don't always remember to do that. And then there are times in the past, we don't do this anymore, but we used to have to take ballots out to ask questions about them. Like if we had a question about whether a voter used their, like a different legal name, because sometimes, especially women, will have, they'll have their maiden name and their married name, and they'll sign their ballot with like their maiden name, but they'll be registered under their married name. And we have to do a little bit of research to find out, does this person commonly use both names? Does this person go by a middle name? And we used to leave the room with those ballots and go ask someone, like one of the elections office staff, to look up that voter record for us, because there's a limit to what we are allowed to look up in the ballot board room. I don't think we've done any of that since the cameras have been installed, because when the cameras got installed, we sort of started becoming much more aware of what our, like what it was we were doing and how it might be perceived, because we were actually were worried that something like this would happen, that someone would see us doing something on the cameras and it would look crazy or illegal. So we stopped doing that. And what we do now instead is we write notes about a ballot. So if we need to know something about a ballot, we'll write a note about it and we'll take the note out to the election staff. Now that note is officially part of election records. So what happens is when they give us an answer, they also bring us the note back and we put the note in our little miscellaneous papers bin, and that note gets stored as part of the elections records. But that's another instance where we might walk a piece of paper out of the ballot board room and the people watching on the video don't necessarily know what it is, but it's just something that we need to do in order to do our jobs.
So back to the May 6th, which you mentioned, and I wasn't there, but since you weren't there, we're going to go there. You said May 6th, this past election day, you took a box of ballots out of the ballot board room, but you came back without the ballot. Okay. And the ballots went where again?
So they were provisional ballots that had been rejected by the ballot board. I was not involved with the acceptance or the rejectance of those ballots. I just happened to be there on election day, and our presiding judge, David, asked me to take them back to the voter registrar's office, which is where they go so that they can be scanned and attached to the correct voter file. And then that office is actually responsible for the storing of those ballots. We don't have anything to do with them after they've been rejected. So the ballots that I left the room with were not countable ballots. They were never going to be counted. They had already been rejected by someone who was not me, and I was simply assigned to do that task by our presiding judge.
Now, did you leave the building with the ballots, or did you take them to another part of the building?
No. I just took them to another part of the building. There's like sort of three divisions of the elections building. There's the front office. There's the middle office, which is like the early voting area. That's where the ballot board room is. And then there's the warehouse in the back, which is where central counting is. And the voter registrar's office is in the front part of the building. And just so people know, all of this is on camera. It's not a live feed camera, but there are security cameras all over that building. So I took the box with the ballots in it. I walked it to the voter registrar's office. I handed it to I'm not sure what her title is. I think she's the deputy voter registrar or something like that. I gave them to her. She told me that there were more ballots from earlier that week that hadn't been returned. And I went back in the room. I told David, hey, she says there's more ballots. And he said, oh yeah, they're in the closet. And I said that I'd take them back. So I took those back as well.
So you took two boxes out instead of one. So on May 6th, saying on May 6th election day, you took two boxes of ballots out of the ballot board room, and you took them to the registrar.
The voter registrar.
Okay. So when we're talking about the video that's on YouTube, that's posted by Progressives for Liberty, what period of time in that day were you actually the person in charge, where David had left the room and you were the supervisor of record or judge of record?
It would have been, I don't know what, I don't, okay, so I can't give you timestamps because I don't actually know what the timestamps on that video are, but on that video, you can see there's a conversation that where Jocelyn and I are working and David's got his coat on and then he leaves for the day. So after David leaves, I am effectively the person in charge. Like if you're looking for like who's in charge of the ballot board right now, that would be me. It's not officially like that way. Like David is still in charge of the election. I'm just in charge of whatever we're doing in the room at that time. So that would be the period for which I am, you know, nominally in charge. Is after David leaves, then I become responsible for everything.
So that time frame is what, an hour that you're still there after he leaves, or 2 hours or 3 hours? What time is it?
I don't know because I don't know what the timestamps on that video are, but I would guess that he probably left around 4. That's usually when we stop working. And the election office closes at 5, which is when we all stop working. So it was no more than an hour.
So does he take a lunch break?
He does take a lunch break. I don't know if he took a lunch break that day. I don't know how he handled lunch that day.
But typically, does he take an hour lunch break?
It depends. Sometimes we all take an hour lunch break. Sometimes we work through lunch. And it completely varies by day. Sometimes David has, like, a lunch appointment with a friend. Sometimes we all go out to eat. Sometimes we just eat lunch in the room. Sometimes we eat lunch in the break room. Sometimes we're super busy and we work through lunch. So I have no idea what happened at lunch that day or any other day, honestly.
Okay. So if, and I think this is just a fair question, did you and Jocelyn Pansy work together in concert to alter the results of the November 2022 Tarrant County election?
Absolutely not. And just for the record, I've never worked in concert with anyone to alter the results of any election in the entire time I've been involved with elections.
Okay. And this is another fair question because grandma want to know, were you placed on the Tarrant County Ballot Board to alter any election results since you've been on the ballot board?
I was placed on the Tarrant County Election Ballot Board, Tarrant County Ballot Board, because our previous appointee to the ballot board resigned. Our county chair needed, I had skills that would be good for that job. I like forms. I like documentation. My background is in research. So I like to be able to document processes and I like things to be, like experiments. I like them to be, basically recreatable. Like you should be able to read what someone did and then reproducible. That's what it's called. And so one of the things that I've done on the ballot board is work to make our documentation process better so that if anyone comes in to audit it, they'll be able to tell exactly what we did. So no, I was placed on there because I had a specific skill set that was needed at a specific time, and that is it.
So when people say that, as far as the e-ballots were concerned, you and Jocelyn prefer to work together as opposed to working with the rest of the team, why did the others feel that way?
I don't know, and I don't know who said that, and I don't feel that that's true. We have actually intentionally tried to teach other people to do it, and I want to say it was in November, but during the November election. We actually worked in a team of 3. So it was me, Jocelyn, and a Republican. Jocelyn and I often get told to do that job because David's the one who assigns jobs. So he'll be like, I want Kat and Jocelyn to do that. And the reason that he'll do that is because the process of creating a duplicate ballot is a very detailed and it requires a lot of documentation. You have to, there's a lot of stamping involved. There's recording of certain information about the ballot. You have to be, paying attention to what you're doing when you're recreating a ballot so that you don't, mark it incorrectly. And then you have to go back and double check it to make sure that what you created is actually a match to the original. And then it all has to be stored in a very specific way. So David will assign us to do that because he knows that he can trust us to do it properly without a bunch of errors. And what we tried to do in October, November. I'm going to say October a lot, but what I mean is the November election. We actually included people who hadn't done it before because I want to make sure that if I'm out sick, that people have those skills. And now I'm really glad I did because if I'm not there, I have passed on that knowledge to other people. So we try to make sure that we train other people to do specific jobs, so that everyone has those skill sets. So it doesn't matter if, we get hit by a bus or something. Other people will be able to carry on with that work. But I don't have anything to do with, saying, I'm going to be in charge of all the e-ballots. That's a decision David makes. David has, you know, taken me off other tasks before, like for ballot carrying. He said that I wasn't going to have anything to do with ballot carrying because he wanted me to do other tasks. And so he gave that to like Tammy and Dwayne, who are the Republican and the Libertarian. So whoever has whatever task, that's the job of the presiding judge to assign them to do it.
Well, let's talk about ballot carrying, because it was stated in that video that they said that you appear to cure more ballots at a higher rate than the Republicans. So how is that possible?
Okay, so we don't have individual ballot carrying rates during a general election, which is an election where David is in charge and we all work together on one ballot board. But what we had last year was primary elections, which are run by individual parties. So we have a Democratic and Republican primary. For the Republican primary, David was the presiding judge. I think Brenda Helmer was the alternate judge. For the Democratic primary, I was the presiding judge. And I asked Jocelyn to be my alternate judge, even though she's not a Democrat. And she checked with her party to see if she would be allowed to do that, if it would affect her ability to participate in their party convention. They said no. And I basically told my party, I don't care if she's not a Democrat. She's really good at this job, and I trust her to be in charge if I'm not there. So she's going to do it, and y'all can just suck it up, because that's the kind of relationship I have with my party. They trust me to make good decisions for the ballot board, and they were like, okay, whatever. And I will note again, I think I said this last week, but David actually asked Jocelyn to be on his ballot board for the primary because she is really good, and we both want her to work with us. But I had asked her the week before, so I had, you know, I got there first, so she worked with me. So then last year was the first year we were allowed to do ballot curing, and that was after the 2021 legislature passed the SB1 law. So the rate of curing ballots for the Democratic Party, the primary, was significantly lower, in my opinion, than the Republican rate of curing ballots. That is a statistical fact. It's something that we kept track of, and it's something that we worked really hard on, and I'm actually really proud of it, because we knew after SB1 passed and people had to start including their ID numbers on the ballot that a lot of people were going to have problems with it because they don't read instructions, or they're forgetful. But a lot of them, they just don't read instructions. A lot of people have been voting by mail for a long time. They're old. They're just like, I know what I'm doing, and they're not paying any attention to anything else. So we actually started strategizing about, like, what we could do about it way before the primary election. And what we decided was that, see how it goes, because we didn't know what we could do about it. And we didn't realize until, I think, the first week of signature verification, I think, was done, was that actually it was possible, based on the public information that Tarrant County Elections publishes, for people who are not on the ballot board to find out whose ballot is in a QS status, because of the way the QS codes work, the cure ballot status, there's like several different codes for ballot status based on what needs curing on a ballot. So, and I mentioned this last week, Tarrant County Elections publishes what ballots have been returned to the office every day during an election. Mm-hmm. So every time we go in and we work on ballots, that list gets updated. It's possible for someone to go in, pull that list up, find out what the status of a ballot is, sort it out in an Excel spreadsheet, and then contact that voter and say, hey, I'm your precinct chair. I noticed that your ballot needs to be cured. Can I help you with that? Do you need someone to come around to your house with a computer? Do you need a ride to the polls or to the elections office? Did you know that this has happened? Have you gotten your notice yet? Do you need us to tell you what the website is? Do you want to call the voter protection hotline? We are able to provide that service to voters so that if they're having problems, we can help them with that. And because it's a Democratic primary, all of the people in our primary were Democratic voters. We have not done that. Well, no, I lie. I don't know what they've done in the general elections, because there's no way in a general election to know what party a voter is in from the ballot board end. so we don't have anything to do with that. But that was like a really big effort that we undertook with our Democratic precinct chairs, is to, you know, get organized, pull that list every day, make sure the precinct chairs were calling their, you know, their voters and saying, hey, do you know that this is going on? Do you need help carrying your ballot? How can we help you to make sure that your vote gets counted? The other thing that we did is I had way more clerks working in the ballot board room, and we were making calls. We were working late hours. We worked on weekends a couple of times. I had a whole team of clerks who all their only job was to make phone calls to voters and say, hey, your ballot needs curing. You can go to this website or you can come into the office to cure it. So we put in a lot more work on that.
Can I pause you for a second? Because I need to understand, what does curing mean? Does that mean actually validating something, or what is curing?
Okay, so curing means that a voter, yes, they provide or they validate information that is on their ballot. Most of the curing that happens is related to the ID numbers. So if someone doesn't put their ID numbers on their ballot, or they put ID numbers that are incorrect or that don't match the ID numbers we have on file for them, they have an opportunity to correct that. And there's two ways they can do it. They can go to the Secretary of State website and log in, and they have to put in a ton of personal information, including both of their ID numbers, like their Social Security number and their Texas ID number, and their address and all that stuff. And then they can log in, and there's an option for them to cure, like to fix problems with their ballot. And
well,
then the other way is that...
Let me pause you right there. So is that what you were accused of doing on the Secretary of State's website by the people on the video? Is that what they were saying you were doing?
That's what I was accused of doing. Yes.
Okay. So wait a minute. So to be clear, the video accuses you of going to the Secretary of State's website and basically validating people's ballots when you are not supposed to be validating people's ballots with the Secretary of State's website, or what is it accusing you of?
That is what I think it's accusing me of. It's pretty vague, so, like, I didn't understand what specific accusation they were using at first, because I didn't understand why they were trying to say I had a different cure rate, because I wasn't involved in curing ballots in October, and we don't measure it by like, oh, Brenda's got, you know, 20, but Kat's got 40 or something. Like, we don't do that. And it didn't occur to me until a little bit after I had watched it that they meant that the cure rates were different for the primaries. And that is 100% true, and I'm 100% proud of it, because we worked really hard to make sure that we did a lot of voter contact, that we actually wrote, I wrote like a 4-page letter that had like a diagram included in it. That explained exactly what the, like, here's the problem with the ballot, here's how you can fix it, and here's what you need to look for in the future. Because I actually like to tell voters if there's something wrong, I want them to understand what it is so that they don't do it in the future. So we went, like, above and beyond, like, doing everything we could to make sure that voters were able to cure their ballots, and it was very effective. And that is shown in the difference between our rejected ballot numbers and the Republican rejected ballot numbers. We worked really hard to be there for voters.
I think they said, according to that video, there were 610 e-ballots and 608 were certified, which was a really significantly higher number than typical. Is that what happened?
Well, so e-ballots and cured ballots, those are not the same thing. An e-ballot is a federal overseas ballot. Voters are FPCA voters, which is the federal postcard application, and it applies to military overseas, military family members overseas, and overseas citizens, so like someone who's a citizen of the United States, but they may live in a different country, to vote in federal elections, so like their president and stuff like that. But they can't vote in local elections. I don't know what the specific numbers were in October, November, but it's actually not unusual to approve all of the e-ballots, because people who vote a federal postcard application really want to vote. Mm-hmm. Like, they're highly motivated. They have to get that ballot. They have to get it emailed to them. They have to print it out. They have to mark it, and then they have to mail it back at overseas postage rate. So they are very, you know, we approve most of them. There's only like a handful that we don't approve. Like I remember we've had one voter who's in another country and he's a disabled veteran and he put the wrong number, the wrong ID number on it, and he didn't have a way to fix it in time. And so we had to tell him that we weren't going to accept his ballot. And that was really, you know, that's a really difficult thing to tell someone, but that's very rare. Most e-ballots do get accepted. That is not cure ballots. Cured ballots, most ballots that need curing do not get cured.
Okay, then let's go back. The FPCA, y'all, which she just said stands for the Federal Postcard Application. So those were the ones that per the video, they said a lot of them, the majority of them, in fact, had local postmarks. These people are supposed to be people that are overseas, out of the country. So how is it that they had local postmarks?
So I don't remember that being the case. Usually when they're overseas ballots, they are like distinctly overseas ballots. They're addressed from places like Germany and Switzerland and China and, you know, Australia, like wherever. They come in like FedEx and UPS and, you know, British Royal Mail envelopes. They are very obviously from overseas. I remember in November we had one conversation about at least one ballot. I don't remember if there were any others, but it was addressed from North Carolina. I don't remember there being anything from DFW, like the local, the actual local area. I won't say there wasn't, but I don't remember it. However, I remember this one from North Carolina because North Carolina is the site of Fort Bragg, which is a major American military base. And my brother was actually stationed there for several years, so I'm familiar with it. And what occurred to me is someone had asked me a question of like, how come this was sent from the United States if it's supposed to be an overseas voter? And the very obvious explanation, because my dad, my brother, and my mother were all military members, they were in the Army, is that you can't control your orders. So if you get orders that you're going to deploy to another country and that gets changed for some reason and you don't deploy, but you've requested an email ballot, you still get that ballot. It's not mailed to a physical address, so it's not like you're getting mail in Germany and you're not there to collect it. It gets emailed to you at your email address. You're still allowed to vote it because you're eligible to vote that ballot. You can fill it out, mail it back in, and maybe that comes back from Fort Bragg or wherever you happen to be living at the time. Same thing for family members. Like maybe if you're a military spouse and your spouse gets deployed and you were planning to go with them, but for some reason you stayed back, maybe you're going to join them later. You got an e-ballot, you're eligible to vote that ballot and send it back. That is not we're not legally allowed to question that. Other people, if they want to challenge the ballot, they can do that.
But I think according to the narrator of the video, he said these FPCA applications, which is the federal postcard applications, the majority of them had local postmarks. So you don't recall that, and to me, y'all, local means DFW. That's how I interpret local. Now, it's going to be up to the interpretation because he did not clarify local, but to me, local would imply that they were postmarked within, you know, the Fort Worth DFW area. So you don't remember seeing a whole lot of envelopes with DFW postmarks?
I don't remember seeing any. That's not to guarantee that there weren't. I don't know. We do retain those records. They're part of the election records. They get sealed up in a box along with all of our other election materials. So someone could have a court order that they be unsealed, or they could wait until after the election and ask to examine them as part of the public record, I think. I'm not sure how that works, but I assume that that would be possible. I don't remember seeing anything that was federal, like an e-ballot that was actually mailed locally.
Gotcha.
What I think they meant by local was mailed within the United States as opposed to an overseas foreign country ballot. Again, this is my problem with the video is that it's misleading, and I think there are some things that are outright lies, and there are some things that may not be intended to be lies, but they're misunderstandings of what's going on by the people who created the video or provided information about the video.
Okay, y'all, I did not stick to the script tonight. I said, listen, if you had a question or a comment tonight, she's going to take questions in the 8 o'clock hour, and I have clearly gone way over the 8 o'clock hour, and it's 8:30. If you have a question or a comment for Kat, the phone number is 515-605-9321. Then press 1 once connected. That's 515-605-9321. Then press 1 once connected. I see Adrian has a question for you. Good evening, Adrian. How are you?
Hey, good evening, Carrie. Thank you for allowing me on this evening. Hey, to your guest tonight, Kat. Miss Kat, hello to you again. Thank you for your willingness to come on. Thank you for your willingness to come on for a second discussion. I'll get right to it. Now, this is how I look at life. You know, in order for us to understand somebody, you gotta ask questions, and that's the best way you get to understand and get to know somebody. Ask questions. You know, listen to what they're saying and take it in, and just, you know, make your intellectual judgment or whatever opinion is about the individual. You just go for nerve, whatever. But my thing is this, considering your, I want to say is thank you for also clarifying the situation regarding Miss Mason, because I think the narrative was still out there. She knew what she was doing, and, you know, she just disregarded everything, and that's why she ended up in the situation she was in. But thank you for clarifying that, you know, the process of what happened and how it was rejected, this, that, or the other. And of course, we know that it was, you know, what the outcome was of that situation. But considering you have openly, shared your diagnosis as, you know, dealing with bipolarism and ADHD. It was ADHD?
Yeah.
Since you've been in a position you have been in, working with the elections commission, this, that, or the other, do you feel any, do the people around you that work with you, do they know about your diagnosis? You know, people that you work directly with, were they aware of your diagnosis?
Yes, absolutely. Deborah Peoples, when she appointed me, was fully aware of my diagnosis. I am not shy about it. I mm-hmm. think of myself as a mental health advocate, so I actually am completely open with it. I tell people, like, you know, when I'm feeling depressed, my presiding judge knows about it, my elections administrator knows about it, like, everyone knows about it.
Okay, and it just leading up to my next question. With that being said, and again, thank you for being your openness and willingness to share that with us, you know, do you feel anybody has directly or indirectly tried to use that as a means to benefit themselves? You don't have to say who, what, you don't have to say who, but personally, have you ever internalized that this person trying to get me to do something, you know, go against my moral beliefs, this, that, or the other? Have you personally internalized that?
I don't think so, as far as my work on elections and with the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. No, everyone has been completely supportive. They've never tried to influence me to do anything. I don't ever feel like mm-hmm. I've been manipulated. And I don't feel like when I have, like, I'm a very stubborn person. David and I argue a lot about, like, procedures, and sometimes we have arguments about whether the law should be interpreted this way or a different way. And I never feel like he's, called me crazy. I have known people in the past who've been like, Kat, you're just, you're being, you know, I don't want to say a bad word, but like, you're being a B because you're, mm-hmm. you know, having mood. I have never experienced that in elections.
And this will be my last one, Carrie, because I want to, you know, give somebody else time.
Mm-hmm.
This David guy.
Is that Hello? You, Adrian? Was that your phone?
No, what happened?
It was like this like noise out of nowhere. Like someone was trying to disrupt the show. I don't know. Did you not hear the noise?
I didn't hear it. It must have been something coming through a messenger. I kind of just got a message, but I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I'll be real quick. So one question, two questions, and I'm gonna stop one and I just listen. David's political affiliation and two, what was the second question I wanted to ask you? Because I ain't asking you nothing that's going to probably incriminate, but have you heard any rankings that there might be some type of investigation going on? And do you know the source of that, or that video? Do you think you know the source of that video coming out and the person who's narrating it? And those are my last two questions, Carrie.
Okay. David Lambertson is the Republican and presiding judge. He was appointed by Rick Barnes in 2021. Previous to that, our Republican presiding judge was, why have I forgotten his name? Kelly Roberson. He was the person who really taught me how to, you know, how to act as a ballot board judge and what the procedures were and what we should do. But David has been, I've been working with him longer. Like I said, we don't always agree, but I know that he is coming from a good place. He hates paperwork. I love paperwork, so we work really well as a team in that sort of way. And I have felt really supported by him. I know that he dislikes a lot of the lies that are going around, like the election denialism about how there was so much fraud in 2020, and we need all sorts of, you know, laws that are not really helpful and will only make it more difficult for people to vote. And he's been vocal within his party about that. So I really like working with David. I mean, we fight a lot, but it's more like brother-sister kind of fighting. So David's a pretty good guy. I am aware of who published the video. I don't know if there's actually a person speaking or if it was done by, a voice generator. I don't know who the narrator is. I'm aware of who published it, and I believe I'm aware of people who contributed to it, because some of the things that I mentioned could only be known by conversations that were had in the ballot board at specific times. I'm not going to make that public because I don't want this to turn into partisan sniping. I don't want it to be like, oh, the Republicans are accusing the Democrats and the Democrats are just banding together. I don't want it to be that. That is not the spirit of ballot board. We work very hard to be nonpartisan, to include Republicans, Democrats, and Libertarians in everything that we do, and to do our jobs for the voters of Tarrant County. That is what we're there for. That is what we try to do. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the second question.
One was David's political affiliation, and then two, the source of the video. Thank you, Kat.
I have not heard anything about an official investigation. I said last week I was going to go to the sheriff's office on Monday, and I ended up not doing that because I was really depressed and stressed out this week. I had to have an appointment with my psychiatrist, actually, to get my antidepressant, the dosage moved up, because it wasn't, I'm on a very low dose and it wasn't working for me. So I haven't really been able to do much this week proactively. And I'm not sure if I should. I've had time to consider it, and I don't know, because I've never filed a police report. It's very weird. I don't even know what I'd say. Someone said something bad about me. Do something about it. That's not something they can do anything about. But I actually would like there to be an investigation, because if they think they've done something wrong, then someone should tell me what I did wrong so I know. And if they find that there was nothing bad done, then I would quite like them to issue a statement so that I can go back and work on ballot board, because that's something I really love and I feel like I've lost it. And so I would like there to be an investigation. I don't know if it makes sense for me to be the one who reports it. I assumed it had already been reported. And I don't know how long an investigation takes, so I don't know how long it might be until I hear from someone about it. And until I do, it's almost like this weight hanging on me that I'm like, oh, what's going to happen, you know?
Mm-hmm. Listen, have you spoken with Deborah Peoples or Allison Cambolo over at the Democratic Party about this tape, and what are their thoughts?
I haven't really talked to them beyond, Deborah wished me, a happy Mother's Day to me and my mom, and was like, we love you. And Allison, I talked to about it just in terms of, like, did she asked me if I wanted the county party to make a statement, and she asked me what I wanted to do about it. But she hasn't told me specifically to do anything. I told her that if the party wanted to make a statement, they could, but they didn't need to feel obligated to do so. I told them if they wanted to distance themselves from me, that was fine with me. I wouldn't take that to heart. My feelings wouldn't be hurt. But everyone, including Allison, has been really supportive. They see this as like an intentional attack that was just done to undermine public trust in the elections, which is how I view it as well. But all the decision making, they've been like, Kat, you just need to take care of yourself, your mental health, and make the decisions that are best for you. And we support you and we love you. And so that has been another part of my like support system that has been really valuable.
Gotcha. We're going back to the phone line, 314-677. Good evening. You're on Let's Talk at Work.
Well, you know, there is a lot of election fraud going on, more so than I've ever known, especially in Democratic wards, because I've been around them for quite some time. Matter of fact, if you walk by a cemetery the next day after an election in them Democratic strongholds, all the graves look like they've been disturbed as if somebody got up out of them on election day. But here's the thing. Anyone that's handling ballots should be bonded. And I'm for having separate ballots. The federal ballot with the president, vice president, Congress people, that should be separate from state and local, because with state and local, illegals can vote. There should be a separate way to vet people who are eligible to vote federally. Illegals can get driver's license. Illegals can buy homes. And those driver's license and the closing paper on that mortgage, you take it down to your election board and you can register to vote. There's nothing else they can ask you. And they illegally shouldn't be voting on federal elections. Now, some states and also municipalities allow illegals to vote. Look at California. They allow illegals to vote on school board election. But they shouldn't be voting federally. And the federal elections should have a vetting system that can make sure that those people are allowed to turn in ballots to cast that ballot. And ballots should be counted where cast. They shouldn't be carried all over the state. So those things that have to be put in place in order for the American public to have faith in the election process. The Constitution allows separate ballots. Congress can't put that in place. And I think that at some point in time, they should. So I don't know what to tell you. The reason why some people don't have faith in the system is because something is going on. It's kind of like Bigfoot. All these people can't be lying. It's got to be something there. And these movies that's coming out where you show people walking up to ballot boxes with piles of ballots in their hand, and dump them in like they're dumping out the trash, there's something going on there. And people don't like it. In Detroit, they wouldn't allow monitors in. They put dark paper over the window so you couldn't see in. You can't say something ain't going on. So I'm not saying that you are, but something is going on. Carrie, your opinion.
My what? You said my what?
Your opinion.
My opinion, you know, I'm trying to stay neutral because I know so many people that ran for office this time. So I know there were a lot of disappointment, you know, and so I'm just really trying to show balance with this story without, you know, interjecting what I really think. Because I really don't know. It's one of those situations where I really don't know. But she had some good ideas. And I actually agree with some of the suggestions that she said people were saying. You know, Kat, we talked in the pre-interview today, and on the last show, you mentioned that there were some changes that people were recommending that get done in order to make these elections fair. Can you go over those again?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of things, so we don't have time to cover it all in the show. I will say that the issue of bonding, like having bonded members of the ballot board came up in the last show. That's a really interesting question, I think, because there should be the way it works now is it's a trust system. Like the county party appoints and approves the members of the ballot board as well as all the election judges in the county. And this is done on trust. Like they're people that have been with the party that you know that, and then we try to balance it by having multiple parties at each polling location and stuff like that. The ballot board list gets approved by the election board, which is a bipartisan committee, the elections administrator, both county party chairs, and I want to say the sheriff and the county clerk. The county judge and the county clerk. I'm sorry. It's listed on the election side. I can't remember. And then commissioner's court approves election judges. So there is an approval system and process, but it's maybe not as thorough as some people would like. That would be a discussion I would be willing to have, is like, how can we increase trust in these people that we're appointing beyond just, oh yeah, someone says they're good. So that's an interesting conversation that could be had. There's also there's no training for ballot board. Like there's training for election judges, but there's no standardized training for ballot board. When I came on, no one told me how I was supposed to do my job or even what my job was. I would like to see the Secretary of State publish like some sort of training and like make it mandatory. They don't even provide us with the handbook that tells us like how to handle, you know, what our duties are and how we're supposed to handle certain things. Like, you know, if a voter forgets to sign a ballot, they don't provide us that. I've had to ask the elections office to print that out so we can have it in the room so we can refer to it. So there's a lot of things that can be done that are minor that don't require like, you know, legislative changes that would just generally improve the ease and that we actually do this job with. There's a lot of bills that are going through the state legislature that are claiming that they're going to address election integrity, but they don't. What they actually just do is make it harder for people to vote. Like if you voted in Tarrant County the last couple of years on election day, you could vote at any location. That's called a vote center. The Tarrant County GOP, like today, I think, published a statement. There's an article about it in the Star-Telegram about they want to eliminate vote centers. But that makes it a lot harder for people who, like, because Tarrant County's big. If you work, like, if you work in Dallas and you live in, like, West Tarrant County, you might not get home in time to vote on election day, right? So then you need to vote early. But what if you can't get time off? Or what if you are absent during early voting, but you're going to be here during election day, then you don't qualify for a ballot by mail. So you would have to get time off, come back to Tarrant County, and then possibly go back to work. It's just a lot harder for people. It doesn't make the election safer. It just makes it harder. But there are a lot of things like that. And anytime someone brings us a problem, we try to think of how we can solve it and, you know, actually address that question. That's been something that Heidi Garcia is good at.
In Missouri, every voter has to be off of work 3 hours before the polls close. So if their normal day, polls close at 7 o'clock. If their normal day is 4:30, they get off at 4, and they get paid that half hour between 4 and 4:30. That's what goes on in Missouri.
I think that would be a good law. I also think that Election Day should be a federal holiday for everyone in the country so that you're guaranteed to be off on Election Day. And if you're an essential worker, like a doctor or something, and you can't be off, then we still need to have early voting periods where you're guaranteed to have, you know, time off. There is a law that says your boss has to give you time off to vote. But as you know, bosses are not always great about following laws like that. I also think that, like, if we had some sort of national voter database, like a voter ID card, that would be really helpful. And I think that there actually are a couple of systems like ERIC. I think we need to improve the way that states talk to each other about, like, motor voters, like people who move between states, so that we can keep our poll books updated. There's a problem with the Secretary of State right now. Oh, you mentioned, like, registration problems. I can't speak to every election in the country. I can only speak to the elections in Tarrant County and, to a limited extent, the Texas Election Code. How we verify that people are eligible to vote, that's actually the Texas Secretary of State. They maintain a statewide voter database, and it's their job to vet people. So if anyone has concerns that there are people who are not eligible to vote because they're, you know, undocumented or they're registered to vote in two different states or something like that. That is a concern mm-hmm. that you need to take to the Secretary of State. And the last time they did a purge of voter rolls on this basis, it was thrown in the court.
The voter rolls should be purged, if they're not, once a year, every 2 years. Everybody has to go back and register again. And there should be some biometric means of telling who's who. For instance, the technology is out there where the iris in your eyes can be used as an identifier, the way it is when people enter into buildings and also certain departments in buildings where only certain people should be in. But I want to know this. What is the penalty for someone who's caught indulging in voter ballot improprieties? I think it should be 20 years and $250,000 fine myself, but what exists now?
It depends on what it is, and it also depends on whether or not they were knowingly doing it. So, like, Crystal Mason unknowingly voted a provisional ballot. She didn't know she wasn't eligible, and that the way that the law was written, they didn't take that into account, the fact that she did it unknowingly. So, that's actually a serious question. I don't feel comfortable getting into it in, like, the 9 minutes we have left. I'm not opposed to there being other sort of, like, fingerprints or biometric identification, but it needs to be, like, a really serious, thorough discussion. And, again, I just don't feel comfortable doing it in the 9 minutes we have left. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Bianchi. I appreciate you calling in tonight. You know, Kat, I think the sheriff, it is said, was out at the Elk Lodge last night. And I understand, I have not seen the video, but I've been told that the sheriff said that there was no election fraud in Tarrant County. Do you think that that statement vindicates you, or do you think that there's something else going on?
I think probably what the sheriff was referencing was the 2020 election, which is the election that most people are skeptical about. And the sheriff has made that comment before at commissioner's court meeting, and I was actually there when he made that statement that there was no election fraud in Tarrant County. And that was supported by the audit that the Secretary of State did of Tarrant County and four other counties. I think it was Colin Harris and was maybe Dallas. So that is, I believe it's a true statement. I also personally believe that's true for all of our elections, at least since I've been working there. I've never seen anything that looked like fraud in like a major way, and especially not by any election workers. I know that there are allegations of misconduct by individual election workers, and that when we notice that, we report it to the appropriate channels.
Gotcha. So Bob Willoughby, I think, originally was saying that he wanted a recount. And I think there is a very tight window in which you can actually make that happen. So I understand that he has decided to ask for, or he's actually contesting the election. Can you tell us what that would mean for the actual election when someone contests the election?
I can't, because the ballot board doesn't have anything to do with that, and I've never been involved in that process. But you're right, there is a tight window to do it, and there's like very specific situations in which it can be done. He's perfectly within his right to want that and request that, but I mean, frankly, I don't think it's going to have any effect. I think the results will be what they were originally published as.
Wow. And for anybody who's tuning in late, just for a recap, you know, this is, you know, about a video that was released by Progressives for Liberty on YouTube, in which the narrator accuses Kat Cano and Jocelyn Pankey of something that appears to be voter fraud. So in that, will you again recap why it appears that you and Pianki, Pianki were appearing to stay behind after the close of that business day, and it appears you all did additional work without anyone else in the room, and both of you all were working for the Democratic Party, which is against the rules, and the officer who normally guards the room was not there. So for a recap, can you explain what it was that you all were doing that that's confusing to people and makes the narrator look like he's correct?
Right. So what we were doing, we started the job we were working on, we started during the day when multiple people, including the Republican presiding judge, were present. We are not both Democrats. Jocelyn is a Libertarian. I am a Democrat. She is, you know, a member of the Libertarian Party. I'm a member of the Democratic Party. And so we are not from the same party. So that is not breaking a rule. When we started working, there's a point in the video. You can see us talking to David. We're discussing the situation with him. What had happened is there was something wrong with our ballot count. Like we do what we call reconciliation at the end of each day to make sure that, you know, the number of ballots we say we have is what we actually have, and to figure out how many ballots we process and stuff like that. And there was something wrong with it in the middle of the day. I don't remember what specifically it was. And what I think it was, I'm not going to get into in a public forum just because it's a ballot board, like, internal process, and it's very confusing.
Okay.
So we were working on solving that to make sure that we hadn't missed anything or, accidentally put ballots in the approved batch that weren't supposed to be in there and stuff like that. And what we're doing, what I'm doing with those pieces of paper, those are not ballots. They are ballot sheets. The information that they contain is just like the serial number of the ballot, the identification number of the voter registration certificate, and the name of the voter and the status of the voter, like active or suspended. So it's just a list of ballots. And what I'm trying to do is find a particular set of batch papers that I didn't have when I started looking through them, and I thought someone had thrown them away. And when I say thrown away, that's not a trash bin, even though they call it the trash bin. It's the excess materials bin. So, like, pieces of paper that are voter records, but that we're not using for whatever reason. Like, we have extra copies of it or something. Or we know it was a note we wrote down and we don't need it anymore, so it goes in that bin. That all gets saved. Mm-hmm. That's not the trash bin. But I was looking in there to see if I could find a copy of the piece of paper that we needed. And I don't remember how we resolved it, but we did eventually resolve it. You can see at the end of the video, towards the end of the video, David has a conversation with us and then leaves. At that point, I am nominally in charge, although not, like, officially. Like, I don't become magically the judge. David is just, like, leaving me in charge of whatever's going on. And then we finish our work. At the very end of that, we start getting ready for the next day, which involves doing some we do validation of the ballots, which is we compare the stack of ballots against the batch paper, and we say, hey, it says Mary Smith, Mary Smith is on this ballot list. Do we actually have Mary Smith's ballot, yes or no? And so we do that before we do signature verification. So at the end of the day, or sometimes at the beginning of the day, we'll sometimes come in like 15 minutes early, and we'll do that part of it, the validation. And that is a step that we do in order to make sure that when we tell you we have your ballot, we actually know that we have your ballot. We're just going on faith. So that's what we're doing. Like, we're finishing the work that we need to be doing, and then we're prepping for the next day. And then the two pieces of paper that we print off at the end, they don't contain any personal information. They don't contain any information about candidates. They don't contain any information about the election. They do not even have a time or a date stamp on them. If we want to know what time and day they were printed, we have to write them on ourselves with a pen. They are literally just, it's like a column that lists the status of a ballot, like whether it has been approved to be opened, whether it has been put in question status, whether it needs curing, and then how many ballots are in that status. So it'll say, like, you've got 2,000 ballots that have been approved. You've got another 1,000 ballots that are in processing that need to be looked at by the signature verification committee. And then, you know, all that other stuff. That is public information. We can get it in other ways. It's just a lot easier to get it from that piece of paper. And again, it becomes completely irrelevant at the end of each day when we start doing other things the next day. All those numbers change. So it doesn't have any effect on anything, and it cannot be used to change or influence elections in any way.
So another part of what you all deal with is absentee ballots. So that would involve anybody who was 65 years or older, so anyone who's disabled, anyone who's unable to make it to the polls, anyone who's out of town, incarcerated in a mental hospital, or expected to be given birth within or during the voting period. So they would be under the umbrella of what you all do in the ballot board as well, right? So everybody with an absentee ballot would have been counted in that room.
Yes, all absentee ballots are processed by the ballot board. All provisional ballots are processed by the ballot board. And absentee includes domestic absentee, like that's the 65 and older stuff. And then also it includes the e-ballots or the federal overseas ballots. So all of the mail and all of the provisionals we process.
Gotcha. Okay, Kat, any final comments before we get out of here tonight?
No, I'm just really grateful I got the chance to come on the show again and explain some more things. If you ever want to have me back to answer more questions or just to chat about, like, elections, I would be happy to do so. I love helping people, like, discover elections. And then also I would say, finally, if you have doubts about Tarrant County elections, we are always in desperate need of election workers, and that is a way that you can be involved and not only just help your community vote, but you can be sort of oversight. You can be the eyes and ears, and you can see what's actually going on, and then you can take, you know, your own personal experience back to your friends, and you can help increase trust in elections that way. If you want to do that, contact either your county party, if you're a Republican or Democrat or a Libertarian, or call the Tarrant County Elections Office and say you want to serve as an election worker.
Wonderful. Y'all, listen, that was Kat Cano, basically who came on for a second time to tell us exactly what happened on what appears to be some indiscretions or a breach in voter integrity going on in that October 20th, 2022 ballot board room. So that's what we tried to do tonight with Show Balance in this particular story. The rest is up to whoever's in charge to look into this. So we thank Kat Cano for coming on tonight. We thank you, the audience, for listening. Again, we try to show balance. If you have a business, a product, a service, or a nonprofit that you need to get the word out about, consider advertising right here on Let's Talk What Works. Also, y'all, listen, keep it locked right here on Let's Talk What Works every Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. as we tell you exactly what's going on downtown. All right, y'all, until next Friday. Good night.